when I was writing this book, I thought a lot about how vulnerable we are as human beings, this species on Earth that seems to have adapted past the point of being able to survive. I think we've, especially with this incredible, insurmountable wealth of technology that we have, we've gotten really far from our natural human state as animals living on the planet.
Writer Otessa Moshfegh wonders why humans don't hibernate. A woman at the center of her latest novel tries to sleep for a year. We'll talk with her later in the show about her new book. But first, acclaimed writer James Baldwin is known for exploring race in America. He was a novelist, a playwright, he wrote essays, he appeared on television. But at one point, he took some time away from all of that to write a children's picture book. It's called Little Man, Little Man, A Story of Childhood. It's basically a day in the life of a four-year-old boy in Harlem. Little Man, Little Man was published in 1976, but it wasn't really embraced by critics or readers, and it went out of print soon after. Well, it's back now, and how it was written and how it was rediscovered, those stories are as interesting as the book itself. I spoke a while back with James Baldwin's niece, Aisha Karifa Smart, along with the man who discovered the manuscript and brought it back into print, Nicholas Boggs. He's a James Baldwin scholar at New York University. How did you come across this manuscript, and what caught your eye?
This was about 20 years ago when I was an undergraduate at Yale. I was taking a class on James Baldwin. My professor mentioned this children's book, and I'd read almost everything Baldwin had written, but never heard of this. So I went and checked it out at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library, and I immediately knew that it was something special. I'd never seen anything quite like it before. It sort of looked like a children's book on first glance, and it is one, but it was described as a child's story for adults. It was written entirely in Black English. It explored these mature themes that you wouldn't usually find in a children's book. So I wrote a senior thesis about it, and I set out to try to track down the book's illustrator, Yoran Kazakh.
And you found him. He's French, or he was living in France?
Yes, he was living in Paris at that time. And I was actually told by one of Baldwin's biographers that he was quite likely deceased. But I sent out a bunch of emails to art historians in Paris, leaving my phone number. And a few weeks later, the phone rings at my Brooklyn studio apartment, and it's a raspy French man in his 60s telling me he has many stories to tell me about Jimmy and to come and meet him in Paris.
Oh my gosh.
So I signed up for my third credit card and I
and off you went. All right, yeah. Aisha, let's talk about how this book was written in the first place, because this was written basically at the behest of your little brother Tijon, right?
Yes, it was. We grew up in a building where there were extended family. My grandmother lived on the first floor. We lived on the second floor. My Uncle Jimmy kept an apartment on the ground floor. And later, his younger sister, Paula, took over that apartment when he settled in France. So we grew up in a building with a lot of family. And Uncle Jimmy always used to come home in between speaking engagements, writing books, and traveling and doing his work. And so we saw him often. And he always came to check on us and make sure we were fine and find out what we were doing and what we were learning. And one of my brother's requests was always like, well, Uncle Jimmy, when are you going to write a book about me? You know, and it just turned into a beautiful story because, you know, he requested it and we never thought anything about it. We just knew he was a writer. He was a famous writer and he wrote, you know, all types of books. But we were shocked one day when the book arrived, a box full of books from the original publisher Dial Press, with this hardcover book with a dust jacket called Little Man, Little Man. And we opened up the book and the lead character was TJ. And we just, it was unbelievable. So basically it was a uncle keeping a promise to a nephew.
When you read it, what did you think? Do you remember?
It was sort of surreal. I mean, you can imagine I was a little girl, maybe came out in 76. I was like 9. TJ was 8, because we're very close in age. And just seeing the pictures and seeing people who look like us, who were supposed to be us. He's TJ. I'm Blinky. My mom and dad, you know, are featured in the story, showing them dancing and listening to music and the street life and the urban setting. It was all very familiar. It was just like our story being put into a book. So you can imagine how magical that is for a child.
Oh, my gosh. Incredible. Okay, you referenced Blinky. She's a character in the book, the friend of TJ's. He's got two friends, her and another boy. And she's seen as kind of like a tomboy. She likes to hang out with boys, not girls. And that was you? That was based on you?
Well, yeah. I mean, as an urban kid, it's kind of rough and tumble. You're riding your bike on the street. You're doing all the daredevil stuff. I was like my little brother's, you know, protector. Like, you know, whenever my mom was looking for him or we couldn't find T-John, I had to go and find him. I had to get him out of trouble. I had to, you know, be his keeper, my brother's keeper. So there were never any frilly dresses and stuff like that. Maybe on Easter, but my older sisters came from that era. They're boomers, so they kind of had the crinoline skirts and the lace and stuff. By the time we came along, it was bell-bottom pantsuits with, you know, patches and afros and funky stuff. So, yeah, I don't remember the choice of being a girly girl versus a tomboy. But yeah, I mean, city life for kids is just bike riding, jump rope, lots of running up and down the street.
Sounds like fun, really.
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely totally fun. It was a childhood my uncle never got to have.
Yeah, really. And he lived in that neighborhood growing up as well as a kid.
No, so we grew up on the Upper West Side, but like I said, the Upper West Side was different in the 70s. It was a little, it was not as elegant and, you know, as it is now. New York City neighborhoods were grappling with, you know, economic stuff, and there were all types of people, different socioeconomic backgrounds, lots of children, which you won't see now. You don't see kids in the neighborhood now.
But he sets Little Man in Harlem.
Right. He sets it up in Harlem. But even though he sets it up in Harlem, the story is reminiscent of things that we experienced when we were growing up.
Interesting. And did you wear eyeglasses like Blinky does?
No, but I stared a lot. I sort of just looked through people. So I don't know. You know, I'm sure Blinky, that inspired Blinky, being TJ's older sister and his constant companion, but I'm sure he wrote some other stuff into it, too. So, no, I didn't wear glasses. But I think the glasses are a metaphor for a particular type of sight that a city kid has to have. You have to see a lot of stuff going on. I was trained when I was growing up to, like, watch. If people came too close to you, I was told this person is picking that person's pocket. Watch out for that person. Those people are over there doing, you know, exchanging drugs. I was taught to be able to see beyond my childhood world because I had to protect myself and my little brother.
Can you read a little passage from, from the book?
Yeah, sure. So I'm reading from page 8. And this is about Blinky. And this is TJ talking about Blinky after he hurt his leg. And as Nicholas mentioned, the book is written in Black vernacular, which my uncle wrote a piece called If Black English Isn't a Language, Then Tell Me What Is. So he was very much a proponent of Black English being accepted. But Blinky, she just looking from across the street. Them eyeglasses blinking just like the sun was hitting you in the eye. TJ don't know why she all the time got them glasses on. She say she can't see without them. Maybe that true, if she say so. But TJ put them on one time and he couldn't see nothing with them on. He couldn't see across the street. Everything looked like it was rained on. So TJ ain't too sure about Blinky. It was some white folks at school bought her them glasses. If he can't see out of them, how she gonna see out of them? And she older than he is. She 8 years old. She ought know better, but she a girl. I just think that's hilarious.
That is so funny. So it's really written, it's written in the third person, but it's from the perspective of TJ, who's four.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Talking about Blinky. And on that page, it's a big picture of Blinky. It's beautiful because it's orange, and she's got on these orange glasses, and her eyes look like the sun, and she has two little pigtails, cornrows.
Yeah, so. It's a stunning painting. And this is
this
painting is done by Joran Kozak, the French painter. So it looks like it's a watercolor and also ink, it looks like.
Right.
And Nicholas, as you said, this was meant to be a child's story for adults. Were children meant to read this?
It's an open question, and it's something that I think Aisha and I are both interested in being in conversations about. I recently saw the original typescript manuscript for it, and it had written, Little Man, a children's story, and then he'd crossed out children's and put child's. So it's been described in a whole bunch of different ways. I'm not even sure that he was totally sure of how to describe this book, because it really was an experiment, you know, and I think I interviewed Yoren Kazak in Paris before he died, and I asked him this question. I said, who is this book for? And he said, we wanted to create something new, something people could read if they were 7 or 70.
And Aisha, you said that the glasses were a metaphor and that you were taught to be on the lookout for all of these things that perhaps children shouldn't have to be on the lookout for. And that is described in this book. There are people nodding off on heroin in this book.
Right.
There's some scary stuff that happens. What do you think your uncle was trying to say about childhood?
To me, it's about the realities of Black childhood, but also urban childhood. You have to be street smart. There was the whole phenomenon, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s about the latchkey kids, you know, because parents were working and kids had to take the subway by themselves and come home, or the bus by themselves and come home and let themselves in. This is a reality of city life. I think that this book totally can be read by children, but it has to be explained in a proper context. People have to say, well, this story is a story of what some children, the reality that some children have to live in, and used as a teaching tool to let children know that different environments require different sensibilities and different levels of maturity and growth and understanding. So I think my uncle was just keeping it real. He was just keeping it real. This is the reality. This is kind of how I grew up. The interesting thing about the book is that my uncle didn't have much of a childhood. He grew up in Harlem during the time where there was a lot of stuff going on. But this book is a departure from that, because TJ is definitely playful, whimsical. He's running up and down the street. There's music blaring. It's a happy childhood. He's got a mother and dad who love each other and who are dancing salsa and dancing to African music. And, you know, so it's a totally different picture. So I think he took elements of his childhood and what he was familiar with and the reality of the upper of Harlem and New York City neighborhoods in the 70s, and coupled that with one generation after him, the type of childhood that my brother TJ and I were able to have. We had a lot of fun. We played a lot of games. You know, we had a lot of friends on the block. We had neighbors who loved us, who gave us cookies and stuff like that. I don't think he experienced much of that. So it definitely is an ode to of what can happen in a generation.
I think also what's really lovely is the way he describes people's skin color. That comes up a lot in this book. Blinky's color changes from sunlight to real black coffee. Miss Beanpole, an adult figure in the book, her skin color is described as a little bit white, a little bit colored. Miss Lee is the color of honey and watermelon. And TJ's mama, this one's great, is peaches and brown sugar. I just love that.
To me, that is part of depositing into the self-esteem of Black children how beautiful their color is, because oftentimes the messages we receive about our skin color is negative. So I think he made the effort to describe and use metaphors about the different skin tones within, you know, amongst Black people in ways that were self-affirming.
Yeah. And Nicholas, why didn't this book catch on in 1976 when it was published?
I mean, I think for a lot of the reasons that Aisha just talked about, but I would just underscore what she was saying about, and what you did about the use of color in it just for a second, which is, I asked Yoren Kazak about his use of color, and I said, you know, why? Because you'll notice that some of the children's faces are only partially painted. And I said, you know, why is that? And he said that Baldwin talked a lot about exactly what Aisha was talking about. This was a book that he wanted to address the self-esteem of Black children, but also, Yoren said, in the full light, no one is truly Black or truly white. Mm. I'm not sure that's a message that America was ready for in 1976, but I also think that its kind of genre-bending aesthetic was also not something that we saw back then. I mean, more recently, we've seen the rise of YA literature, diverse books, and more genre-bending books in general, but this was really sort of ahead of its time, I think.
There's one part which I found particularly moving, and that is the description of when TJ goes to bed and he wakes up scared sometimes in the middle of the night, afraid that his parents were no longer there, that they had left, because so many of the kids' parents weren't around. And he had to keep having to be reassured by his parents that they weren't ever going to leave him. I thought that was particularly poignant. Is that in real life, was that a fear that your little brother had?
Absolutely. I think, all children experience that from time to time for various reasons, depending on what they're witnessing in the home. And my father traveled a lot. My father is from Sierra Leone, and he traveled all over the world and had to leave home a lot. And so that probably was, my uncle tapping into that was probably, something that he picked up that, we had to go through as children.
Yeah. And when you were children, did you realize just who he was and
absolutely.
How important he was?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he was always on television. We couldn't go anywhere without him being recognized. And whenever he came to visit, he always traveled with an entourage. There were always people coming over to interview him. And, his books were everywhere as well. He was one of the most recognizable of his time. Authors don't gain that type of recognition. But because mm-hmm. he was also a civil rights icon, which was illumined in I Am Not Your Negro, and was able to be friends with so many very different powerful people within the movement, that also lent itself to the fact that people recognized him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we knew. And our building was known as the Baldwin Building.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, people knew.
Okay, so, Nicholas, you discovered this manuscript a while ago. How did you get it into print?
It's hard to remember the timeline perfectly, but somehow I got excerpts from my interviews, it might have been through Aisha, to the estate and to the executor of the estate, Gloria, and she wrote back to me and said that, she was moved by the interviews and would do everything to hasten the publication. Unfortunately, then Yoran Kazak died. It takes a long time to get this kind of project together. It was really important to me to have Aisha and Tijan contribute to the new edition. There were some major trade publishers who initially expressed interest, but as soon as it went to their marketing divisions, this was probably 10 years ago, the editors weren't able to get it through. So very grateful to Duke University Press for being so forward-thinking and supporting this project right away.
So it actually took something like 20 years, right, around?
It took, from the time that I got the green light to pursue republication, it's taken 15 years.
Wow. My gosh. Okay, so where is the main character now, Aisha? Where is TJ, your brother?
Oh, he lives in Paris.
Just like his uncle.
Yep. Absolutely. Followed in his uncle's footsteps, lives in Paris, works in Paris, has a family, and is delighted that his daughter, Maya, will have this book as part of her repertoire. We grew up in a home full of Black literature, and my mother went through a lot to make sure that we read books where there were Black characters in them, and they were usually authored by Black people. So Little Man was an addition to our already burgeoning library of Black children's books. There weren't as many then as there are now. You had to really look for them. Back then, it wasn't as easy, so she took her time to get even African stories. So we're all very happy that this book is back out and it could be added to what is now a much larger canon than it has ever been of Black children's literature.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
That's Aisha Kharifa Smart. She's the niece of James Baldwin, Nicholas Boggs, James Baldwin scholar, and he teaches English at New York University. We've been talking about Little Man, Little Man, A Story of Childhood by James Baldwin. Coming up, my interview with acclaimed novelist Otessa Moshfegh. Her latest book is about a young woman who tries to sleep for a year. The year leading up to 9/11.
9/11 was a very powerful day, and it really changed New York forever. Everybody has a story from that day.
Otessa Moshfegh, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. My Year of Rest and Relaxation. That's the title of a new novel by Otessa Moshfegh. Sounds like a pleasant experience. Who wouldn't want a year of rest and relaxation? But the novel's main character, a young woman who lives in Manhattan, is anything but relaxed and well-rested. For 1 year, she wants to sleep as much as possible. She ingests an impressive amount of pharmaceutical drugs. She finds the world's worst doctor to prescribe those drugs, a psychiatrist who believes pills are the answer to any problem and who never remembers that her patient's parents have died recently. It's their deaths that seem to be the event that sparks her desire to remake herself through sleep. And so she sets her bills on auto pay. She figures out how to quickly feed herself between periods of sleep. And she tries to distance herself from her only friend, another young woman with some psychological problems. Otessa Moshfegh published her first novel, Eileen, a few years ago. She was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and won the Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction. And she joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So the narrator is unnamed in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And she is pretty. She reminds us frequently that she's very good looking. Mm-hmm. She's a graduate of Columbia. She seems to be wealthy. She's bought her apartment on the Upper East Side.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to have everything going for her, and yet she wants to escape
mm-hmm.
through sleep. And it doesn't seem like a nice sleep. It seems like a fraught sleep.
It's a stressful period of her life,
yeah.
I guess you could say. Sleep is supposed to be a time of rejuvenation and healing. And I think this character who's going for this year of hibernation is looking at it, looking for more than that. She wants to actually wake up a different person without any of the remaining trauma from her past haunting her. So she has very high expectations, and maybe she understands that she's being a little bit delusional. But we can take things quite literally in this book, even though maybe they don't make complete sense. So we take her at her word that this is her mission.
Mm-hmm.
A year of sleep is going to be the solution to all her problems.
It certainly sounds nice. I mean, in the stressful world, to just relax and check out for a while and then be reborn like an animal who hibernates.
Yeah, you have to wonder what it feels like to be one of those animals. I mean, it's strange. Why don't we hibernate?
I know.
I mean, why aren't we covered in fur? But there are animals who have incredible metabolisms and have adapted to their environments in incredible ways. And when I was writing this book, I thought a lot about how vulnerable we are as human beings, this species on Earth that seems to have adapted past the point of being able to survive. I think we've, especially with this incredible, insurmountable wealth of technology that we have, we've gotten really far from our natural human state as animals living on the planet. And certainly the pharmaceutical industry is taking advantage of that. This idea that we're incapable of living well-balanced, healthy lives without help.
Yeah. So her doctor, Dr. Tuttle,
mm-hmm.
can you just describe her and how you came up with this character? Because she does sound like, she sounds like she's crazy herself.
Dr. Tuttle is nuts. and Dr. Tuttle is also a very curious person and a very eccentric person.
That's funny. You say she's curious because I thought she was spectacularly incurious.
Oh, that's interesting.
Her patient, like, she didn't really seem to care why she was there, or why she wanted the drugs, and she accepts her lies that she can't sleep and has insomnia and needs all these drugs without really pursuing it.
Well, you're right that she's not curious about her patient. She does seem curious about advancing her own techniques as a therapist,
uh-huh.
and she gets a little bit woo-woo toward the end of the story. And her ideas throughout the book I mean, it's almost as though she starts out with something logical and then twists it past the point of logic into absurdity, which is sort of a reflection of how I feel about everything, including the way that we look at our own mental health. Dr. Tuttle is a satirical character. She does give a lot of comic relief in a story that I think could otherwise feel pretty heavy and dark.
Yeah.
And she sort of, as the writer, she just came to me. She made me laugh. She made me want to see her do stuff and just let her talk. And, you know, I thought she was an entertaining character and a very necessary figure for this protagonist.
This protagonist seems to have, she has one friend named Riva. And she doesn't really like Riva, or she doesn't really like that Riva comes over all the time uninvited and interrupts her sleep. In fact, sometimes she falls asleep as Riva's sitting there talking mm-hmm. and drinking too much. But then at one point she says, Riva was a magnet for my angst, mm-hmm. and that she provides her with a sense of peace, mm-hmm. and that she could feel above fear, above desire, above worldly concerns when she was around Riva, even though Riva just sort of prattles nonsensically, it seems, at times, mm-hmm. about superficial stuff.
Right. I think, and it is Riva's superficiality that gives the protagonist perspective enough to feel like she's above it all. Compared to Riva, the protagonist is living a really deeply spiritual life. I mean, according to her, Riva's really concerned with image, class, posturing. She seems really kind of trapped in wanting to project a certain image, whereas the protagonist has done this entire sleep project as a way to reject all of those pressures and expectations. Mm. So Riva and the protagonist they're a couple in contrast to one another, and I think they sort of feed off each other through their judgments.
And Riva loves her, or says she adores her. She keeps saying, I love you. And the protagonist mm-hmm. says, never responds mm-hmm. in kind. Mm-hmm. And I felt in a way, and I don't know if you intended this, that Riva was almost another part of the protagonist. Mm. Like it was her other side of her personality that she was trying to suppress. Mm. And also that neediness that she was trying to get rid of.
Right. I mean, I think that whole cliche about what irritates us the most about other people is what we don't want to see in ourselves.
Yeah.
And Riva's neediness and her emotions and how she seems incapable of keeping anything to herself really irritates the protagonist who's just, you know, trapped in isolation.
But she is needy with Trevor, her on again, off again, I don't even want to say boyfriend, the guy
right.
she sleeps with.
Yeah. And I think she hates herself for that. I mean, I think those moments where she reaches out to this ex are moments of real degradation for her and moments that she very quickly wants to forget by taking more sleeping pills.
Yeah. This protagonist seems to have love one thing or one person, and that is Whoopi Goldberg, another mm-hmm. comic element to the novel.
Yes. So while my protagonist spends her time sleeping and then waking and walking around and using the bathroom, she also, to soothe herself, watches a collection of VHS movies that she's had, her cassette collection that she's collected. And this book happens, by the way, at the turn of the millennium.
Right.
So DVDs aren't as common as they are right now. I mean, nobody buys VHS anymore. But
this is when Blockbuster still ruled the world.
Yeah, right.
So imagine that.
Right. And you could buy like pre-owned VHS tapes at Rite Aid, like my character does. So in her collection, she's amassed the entire works of Whoopi Goldberg. And maybe at the beginning, I thought, well, Whoopi Goldberg is a comedian. So it is funny that she's looking toward this funny actress as one of her heroes. But then I really started thinking about what Whoopi Goldberg has meant to me as a person and an artist, and found that her presence on screen really resonates really strongly with me because, and I'm not saying that she's an unskilled actress by any means, but she seems to be so how do you put it? She seems to inhabit herself so fully that whenever she appears on screen, it makes the entire movie look like a set. Like somehow her authenticity makes everything else around her look totally phony. Mm. And I don't mean this in a conceited way, but I've often felt like that. I've often felt like looking around at a dinner party and wondering, why is everybody being so fake?
Uh-huh.
You know? And Whoopi Goldberg just cuts through all of that for me.
There's a lot of self-hatred, it seems, on the part of her character. Reva has a ton of self-hatred. She has an eating disorder. She's bulimic, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've read that you were bulimic as well, or you suffered from an eating disorder for a while, and that you said that writing saved you.
Well, I've suffered in a lot of ways, like I think a lot of young people have. Writing saved me because it was like discovering a purpose, and gives me so much joy to be able to be creative and have projects and learn through my projects about myself and life. And so, you know, I think boredom and purposelessness are like exactly the kind of food that feeds the bacteria of self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I can engage in my creativity, the more fulfilled I feel.
So is your character, in a way, engaging in a big creative process with this project of wanting to sleep, that this is a big sort of way to get to find purpose through her life, through this creative project of sleeping?
That's a question that I want the reader to ask himself or herself. Art factors into this book. Your question is very relevant. You know, the character before she exits her life is working as an assistant at an art gallery in Chelsea, and she's studied art history as an undergraduate. And there is an artist that factors in an important way in the plot of the book. And I want people to ask, is this a creative project, or is she in total denial? You know, and what's the difference? I mean, she's doing this thing in order to change who she is. And it does seem creative. I mean, she needs a strategy. She needs materials, i.e. lots of drugs. She needs a studio, which is her apartment. She needs privacy, which artists need. And she's hoping that through the process of this year, she will have learned something. So,
and
you
yet,
know, you could argue yes.
But yet, she doesn't achieve her goal until a real artist, quote unquote, real artist, comes in and participates in her project.
Mm-hmm.
She can't do it on her own.
That's true.
She needs the help of this sanctioned artist.
That's true. And it's also true that she does not respect that artist. So yeah, I mean, it's complicated, and I think I don't have an answer to your original question, but I do think it's interesting to leave it open. Also, life isn't not like fiction is exactly like life, but we don't always understand why we're compelled to do certain things, and things are a lot clearer in hindsight.
Yeah. Speaking of, the book ends on 9/11. Why did you want it to set it during that event?
Mm-hmm. Well, 9/11 was a very powerful day, and it really changed New York forever. You know, everybody has a story from that day. And I have a story from that day that's like a lot of other people's, that I woke up. I was a senior in college living in Manhattan, and I woke up and heard the news on the radio on my alarm, and took a shower and was going to school when a friend called and said, "Did you hear what happened?" And it hit me that, you know, this is really serious and I should call my cousin because she worked in one of the Twin Towers. That, you know, this was a campus phone call from my friend who lived in another dorm. And as I tried to call her, my cousin, the phones weren't working. And I think that was one of the scariest things that happened to everybody in New York that day, was you couldn't communicate with anyone. I couldn't call my family in Massachusetts. I couldn't call my cousin. I had no idea if she was alive or dead or hurt or, you know, trapped. And it was a day where I sort of reckoned with God. And it's like, if she's really gone, that it's going to be impossible to hold on to hope that this world is a good place. But on the other hand, I said, if she's okay, I'm going to do everything that I can to make my life worth it. So, you know, I was 20 years old and in a phase where making these kinds of self-proclamations and you know, really hardcore decisions about how I wanted to live were right in line with my development into adulthood. And then it turned out that she had overslept. So, that day was big. And I feel like it was a yes from the universe. And what's so sad is that it's a no from the universe for so many others. And I haven't spent a lot of time wondering what would have happened if my cousin hadn't survived. But once I started this book and realized that the New York that I was writing was a pre-9/11 New York, I understood maybe subliminally that I wanted to capture that experience of being so stunned by something that happens so close to home, that it really puts you in such close contact with life and death.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. That's Otessa Moshfegh talking about her latest novel. It's called My Year of Rest and Relaxation. Coming up, photographer Joel Satori is creating a record of animals living in captivity. The work is usually easier than shooting animals in the wild, most of the time.
It took about an hour to prep the set, and we used this linen paper that was strong. And one chimp looked at it, stuck its arm in the enclosure, and ripped the whole thing out. And you could hear him screaming as they ripped it all up.
Joel Satori on his photo arc next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. As a photographer for National Geographic for 25 years, Joel Satori has traveled all over the world taking pictures of endangered species. He has captured some of the rarest animals in their natural element, from the Arctic to the Amazon to the African savanna, feeding on bloody carcasses, mating, playing, all sorts of things animals do. But after his wife was diagnosed with cancer in 2005, Joel Satori had to stay home for a while to take care of her and their children. And while he was away from the field, he came up with a new way to draw attention to the world's vulnerable species through his photography. He would take pictures not in the wild, but in the studio. Simple, intimate portraits of every species living in the world's zoos and wildlife sanctuaries to give people a new perspective, a chance to look these animals right in the eye. The hopes are of getting people to really care about these animals. Joel Satori is building a photo ark. So far, he has shot more than 8,000 animal portraits, and about 100 of them are on display now at the Annenberg Space for Photography. Joel Satori joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. What was the initial difference between photographing the animals in the wild and photographing them in a studio?
It's a lot easier photographing them in a studio setting, but we go to the animals. So we build little studios at the various zoos, aquariums, wildlife rehabbers we go visit. We bring little containment tents with us that create a small set for a mouse or a toad or a sparrow. And then for bigger animals, we work with the zoo in advance and have them prep an off-exhibit space by painting it all white or all black. And then they get the animal used to it by feeding them, or that's their night quarters. And then on the day of the shoot, the animal just thinks he's coming in to have lunch, and we take his picture. So so it's a little bit more complicated time-wise, for sure. But it's pretty much a sure thing we're going to get pictures of that animal. Whereas if you work in the wild, it's really hard to find a polar bear that subscribes to National Geographic and will show up dependably. So it's better this way. And the other thing about those previous stories I did 30 stories over 17 years or so, all in the field, was that they come and go in a month, so they don't stick. They don't stick around. And with the photo arc, this is something we hope is archival. Geographic's archiving everything, and hopefully it'll be around forever, whatever forever means.
Mm. Well, talk about a little bit more about the process of getting the animals in the position that you like, because they are incredibly affecting, these photos. They're almost like you're looking at at humans mm-hmm. when you look at their mm-hmm. faces. Mm-hmm. They seem to have expressions.
Right.
I know that I'm anthropomorphizing as I say
that's
that.
That's all right. That's good. That's
is
good.
It, doing, is it good?
That means the photo arc's doing its job.
But is it yeah. good because they're animals?
We're animals too.
Yeah.
See, there's no difference. There's not. They are extremely intelligent. They are survivors. They're playful and joyous and malicious and aggressive and smart. And people don't give animals any credit. So that's my job, is to give a voice to all these different animals, no matter how small or large, and to let them have their voices be heard before they go extinct. We do rare and common animals, but a lot of the species I photograph are not going to make it. So the whole thing with backgrounds is not only does it allow us a clear view of the animal, there's no distractions, and we can look them right in the eye, which humans, we're primates, we respond to the eye contact mm-hmm. big time. But it also, there's no size comparisons, so that mouse is every bit as big as an elephant, just as glorious. That's the whole thing with the background.
So they're shot against a black background.
Against black or white. That's right.
Or white.
That's right.
And they are lit.
They are. Yeah,
really
we
well
light
lit.
The hell out of them. You bet. You
and
bet
they don't
we do.
Get agitated? Or?
No. These are animals that are born and raised in human care, most mm-hmm. of them. And so we're feeding them during the shoots a lot of times. And some of them don't like it, but most are cool with it. And the shoots don't last long. And it's not like we're paparazzi. Maybe we shoot a dozen pictures of the animal. And it's just like us getting a picture taken.
Do you ever have an animal just go crazy in there and ruin the set?
No. Well, I have had chimps. They weren't going crazy, though. They're just kind of smart and fast and strong. We outfit, when I first started the photo arc, I went to this place called the Sunset Zoo in Manhattan, Kansas, and they had these chimps, and they let me put a 8-foot wide roll of white seamless paper up to do this troop of chimps on. And we used this super duct tape and took about an hour to prep the set. And we used this linen paper that was strong. And one chimp looked at it, stuck its arm in the enclosure and ripped the whole thing out. And you could hear them screaming as they ripped it all up. I never got a single picture. I still don't have a good picture of an adult chimp. They're tough. I'm not really working with trained animals that you have to pay for. I'm just going around getting what I can at the world's zoos.
So they're not going into hair and makeup and they're not used to it.
No. These shoots are pretty quick. And they're with a lot of animals that are so rare that we just have really learned how to work quickly. With mm-hmm. birds, sometimes it's a minute. The wow. shoot's a minute or two. And we just want eye contact and then we move on to the next one.
Talk a little bit about Gilda the gorilla. I'm looking at her photo now and she just looks so human.
You're looking at her now. Spin your computer around so I can see that one, because I photographed gorillas a few times. Oh, that's cute. That's Gladys.
Oh, it's Gladys.
From the Gladys Porter Zoo. She was basically given up for adoption by her birth mother. Mom didn't want her. And so she was sent up to the Cincinnati Zoo, and she's a grown woman now, and she lives in the troop with the rest of the gorillas up there. Super sweet, and just like a human baby, needed mom there. So there's this zoo curator, mammals curator named Ron, who was her surrogate mom. And lots of volunteers wanted to hold Gladys and take turns bottle feeding her all night until she got out of infancy. And it was amazing and really clingy and adorable, just like a human baby. Mm. We're very, very similar.
So obviously we're drawn to animals like Gladys, mm-hmm. who look like us.
Yes.
Or furry animals like
sure.
You know, tigers.
Animals with big eyes.
Yeah, those. Yeah. But you photograph a lot of, toads, mm-hmm. rodents, insects.
Right. You're making faces as you say insects.
I know. Not necessarily the most attractive animals.
Right. But really the photo arc's built for them. We all know what gorillas and tigers and elephants look like, but we really have never seen most of the rest of creation or biodiversity. We haven't seen any of this stuff. Little minnows that live in streams, they're jeopardized now by the glaciers that feed the streams melting away. Those are the animals I'm really interested in, the least among us. The things that are brown and crawl and live in the soil, moles and voles and earthworms and even cockroaches, believe it or not. All of biodiversity is
how
what I'm interested
in. How are they endangered?
They're not. We're photographing rare and common species. Okay. We're trying to show the world what biodiversity looked like at this point in time, before humanity squandered half of it.
Because that's coming.
Yeah. By 2100, we're supposed to have lost half of all biodiversity.
Wow.
Half of everything you see in the photo arc. And I want this project, if possible, to get the public to fall in love with these animals and realize that we have to save big chunks of habitat to save them and ourselves, that we're all tied together. We can't kill off half of everything in existence and think that people will be okay. It won't work like that. It's going to be like a Mad Max movie. It's going to be bad. So I can see the bridges out, and I'm just trying to use these cute animal pictures as a way to get people into the tent of conservation, get them thinking. And so people that are listening now, they're thinking, well, you know, I'm on the Santa Monica Freeway. I don't understand how that mouse matters to me. Well, maybe that mouse doesn't. But the thing is, if we kill off, if we have a mass extinction, we are at risk too. We try to get that message across in a fun and friendly way so that we don't turn people off.
So you've been doing this for a while. Have you seen any fruits of your labors?
A little bit. A couple species we've saved from what we thought was going to be certain extinction. Yeah, little things. But this is a long haul message. It's an ad campaign. Like any marketer would know that you have to hit people with the same message over and over again. Politicians know this. In order to see results, it's a generational shift we're looking for. And magazine stories, man, they're gone in a month. Mm-hmm. This hopefully could stick, especially if I could give it a long enough amount of time. We're planning on 25 years if I live that long. We're about halfway done. Give it enough time so that we can really show what the animals of the world look like. And at almost 9,000, we've got a really good idea of that now. And I think by the time we're done, we'll have the biggest, I think right now we have the biggest body of work, studio portraits of animals, different species. So keep going. I was in Berlin last week, actually, and Lisbon the week before that, Spain the week before that.
So. Wow. So you go around from country to country asking zoo officials if you can go in and photograph the animals?
I don't go unprepared. We work with zoos usually starting about 6 months out. And we say, hey, what do you think? And they'll say, yeah, this sounds great. We know of the project, and it's lots of free publicity. National Geographic, we can reach 100 million people each time we post something to social. And they get the use of the pictures, whatever they want to do with them. So we work with them a long time in advance. We say, hey, what do you have in your zoo? Can you send us your inventory? And then we'll go through it, and we find 30 that we need. And they'll say, okay, we can do these 18, because a few of them are birds that live in a big free flight aviary that we can't catch up, and a couple of them are older, and a couple of them would be too stressy, and then we come up with these 18. And so by the time I come to the zoo, it's just very choreographed and quick.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Through all of your travels and photographs, are there any animals that you're particularly connected to that you feel a particular spasm of impatience to preserve?
You mean things that I have photographed or haven't yet?
Either.
There is a single male aquatic frog that lives in the bottom of an aquarium in Cochabamba, Bolivia, that I need to get to soon because he's the last one. They're extinct in the wild. So I need to get to this frog, and I just learned about him last in Portugal, so 2 weeks ago. But in terms of animals that I've met and photographed, I photographed several that have gone extinct or are nearly extinct now. And at the time you're photographing them, you think, I hope that I can be a good detailed witness of this because it's epic and tragic, you know, to lose something. And like the northern white rhino, I photographed the fifth one of those that were alive. Now there's just two left. And, oh, there's a frog in at the Atlanta Botanical Gardens that we all knew was the last one, and he's passed away now. But on the flip side of that, you know, I don't get depressed. I get inspired to tell their stories and keep it from happening over and over again. And I meet people that I would consider to be conservation heroes every day when I'm working in the field, whether it's keepers that tend for these animals and help breed critically endangered species back from the brink of extinction. I've met many people who have saved species almost single-handedly just because they cared. And people that are with NGOs on the ground that are trying to educate people to not poach animals but instead lead ecotours. I meet a lot of people that give me a lot of hope. So I'm just fired up every day when I get up, ready to go.
Zoos are controversial. There are a lot of people who think they shouldn't exist.
They
shouldn't keep these animals in captivity.
There are. Okay, so to that, and I hear them, but nobody likes a bad zoo. But we work at great zoos that are conservation centers now. They're not just these menageries. So a lot of the animals I photographed would be extinct if not for these assurance colonies that they keep in zoos. I met 3 fish last week at the Berlin Aquarium that only exist there, that are from water holes that have been dried up due to pollution or irrigation or both. So,
Are they trying to breed those fish?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They have to keep them going or they will be extinct. The only fish are in the basement of the Berlin Aquarium for now. Oh. That's it. They're little bitty things, you know.
I love how you say, I met 3 fish.
I did. Oh,
like,
yeah.
I met a person.
Yeah. they all count to me. They all count a lot. And so back to the thing about zoos, as 80% of Americans are going to be found living in cities soon, it's the only place they can go to see a wild animal and smell and hear and sometimes touch. When we lose the connection to nature, we will not care about it enough to save it. So I'm a fan of good zoos where there's abundant attention and care and funding. Not a fan at all of bad zoos at all.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks
You're
for coming
welcome.
In today.
Thanks for having me.
That's photographer Joel Satori. Portraits of his project, the National Geographic Photo Ark, are on display right now at the Annenberg Space for Photography. That's it for our special Friday edition of Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.